St. Clair was not, nor her mother before her, indolent and childish, unsystematic and improvident. It was not to be expected that servants trained under her care should not be so likewise, and she had very justly described to Miss Ophelia the state of confusion she would find in the family, though she had not ascribed it to the proper cause. The first morning of her regency, Miss Ophelia was up at 4 o'clock, and having attended to all the adjustments of her own chamber, as she had done ever since she came there, to the great amazement of the chambermaid, she prepared for a vigorous onslaught on the cupboards and closets of the establishment of which she had the keys. The storeroom, the linen presses, the china closet, the kitchen and cellar, that day all went under an awful review. Hidden things of darkness were brought to light to an extent that alarmed all the principalities and powers of kitchen and chamber, and caused many wonderings and murmurings about "dese yer northern ladies" from the domestic cabinet. Old Dinah, the head cook and principal of all rule and authority in the kitchen department, was filled with wrath at what she considered an invasion of privilege. No feudal baron in Magna Carta times could have more thoroughly resented some incursion of the crown. Dinah was a character in her own way, and it would be injustice to her memory not to give the reader a little idea of her. She was a native and essential cook, as much as Aunt Chloe, cooking being an indigenous talent of the African race. But Chloe was a trained and methodical one, who moved in an orderly domestic harness. While Dinah was a self-taught genius, and like geniuses in general, was positive, opinionated, and erratic to the last degree. Like a certain class of modern philosophers, Dinah perfectly scorned logic and reason in every shape, and always took refuge in intuitive certainty, and here she was perfectly impregnable. No possible amount of talent or authority, or explanation, could ever make her believe that any other way was better than her own, or that the course she had pursued in the smallest matter could be in the least modified. This had been a conceded point with her old mistress, Marie's mother, and Miss Marie, as Dinah always called her young mistress, even after her marriage, found it easier to submit than contend, and so Dinah had ruled supreme. This was the easier, and that she was perfect mistress of that diplomatic art which unites the utmost subservience of manner with the utmost inflexibility as to measure. Dinah was mistress of the whole art and mystery of excuse-making, in all its branches. Indeed, it was an axiom with her that the cook can do no wrong, and a cook in a southern kitchen finds abundance of heads and shoulders on which to lay off every sin and frailty, so as to maintain her own immaculateness entire. If any part of the dinner was a failure, there were 50 indisputably good reasons for it, and it was the fault undeniably of 50 other people, whom Dinah berated with unsparing zeal. But it was very seldom that there was any failure in Dinah's last results. Though her mode of doing everything was peculiarly meandering and circuitous, and without any sort of calculation as to time and place, though her kitchen generally looked as if it had been arranged by a hurricane blowing through it, and she had about as many places for each cooking utensil as there were days in the year. Yet, if one would have patience to wait her own good time, up would come her dinner in perfect order and in a style of preparation with which an epicure could find no fault. It was now the season of incipient preparation for dinner. Dinah, who required large intervals of reflection and repose, and was studious of ease in all her arrangements, was seated on the kitchen floor, smoking a short, stumpy pipe, to which she was much addicted, and which she always kindled up as sort of censer, whenever she felt the need of an inspiration in her arrangements. It was Dinah's mode of invoking the domestic muses. Seated around her were various members of that rising race, with which a southern household abounds, engaged in shelling peas, peeling potatoes, picking pin feathers out of fowls, and other preparatory arrangements. Dinah, every once in a while, interrupting her meditations to give a poke or a rap on the head to some of the young operators with the pudding stick that lay by her side. In fact, Dinah ruled over the woolly heads of the younger members with a rod of iron, and seemed to consider them born for no earthly purpose but to save her steps, as she phrased it. It was the spirit of the system under which she had grown up, and she carried it out to its full extent. Miss Ophelia, after passing on her reformatory tour through all the other parts of the establishment, now entered the kitchen. Dinah had heard from various sources what was going on, and resolved to stand on the defensive and conservative ground, mentally determined to oppose and ignore every new measure without an actual observable contest. The kitchen was a large brick-floored apartment with a great old-fashioned fireplace stretching along one side of it, an arrangement which St. Clair had vainly tried to persuade Dinah to exchange for the convenience of a modern cook-stove. Not she. No Pussyite or conservative of any school was ever more inflexibly attached to time-honored inconveniences than Dinah. When St. Clair had first returned from the North, impressed with the system and order of his uncle's kitchen arrangements, he had largely provided his own with an array of cupboards, drawers, and various apparatus, to induce systematic regulation, under the sanguine illusion that it would be of any possible assistance to Dinah in her arrangements. He might as well have provided them for a squirrel or a magpie. The more drawers and closets there were, the more hiding holes could Dinah make for the accommodation of old rags, hair combs, old shoes, ribbons, cast-off artificial flowers, and other articles of virtu, wherein her soul delighted. When Miss Ophelia entered the kitchen, Dinah did not rise, but smoked on in sublime tranquillity, regarding her movements obliquely out of the corner of her eye, but apparently intent only on the operations around her. Miss Ophelia commenced opening a set of drawers. "What is this drawer for, Dinah?" she said.
"It's handy for most anything, missus," said Dinah.
So it appeared to be. From the variety it contained, Miss Ophelia pulled out first a fine damask tablecloth stained with blood, having evidently been used to envelop some raw meat.
"What's this, Dinah? You don't wrap up meat in your mistress's best tablecloths."
"Oh, lor, missus, no. The towels was all a-missin', so I just did it. I laid out to wash, that's why I put it there."
"Shiftless," said Miss Ophelia to herself, proceeding to tumble over the drawer, where she found a nutmeg grater and two or three nutmegs, a Methodist hymn book, a couple of soiled Madras handkerchiefs, some yarn and knitting work, a paper of tobacco in a pipe, a few crackers, one or two gilded saucers with some pomade in them, one or two thin old shoes, a piece of flannel carefully pinned up enclosing some small white onions, several damask table napkins, some coarse crash towels, some twine and darning needles, and several broken papers, from which sundry sweet herbs were sifting into the drawer.
"Where do you keep your nutmegs, Dinah?" said Miss Ophelia, with the air of one who prayed for patience.
"Most anywhere, missus. There's some in that cracked teacup up there, and there's some over in that our cupboard."
"Here are some in the grater," said Miss Ophelia, holding them up.
"Laws, yes, I put 'em there this morning. I likes to keep my things handy," said Dinah. "You, Jake, what are you stopping for? You'll catch it. Be still, there," she added with a dive of her stick at the criminal.
"What's this?" said Miss Ophelia, holding up the saucer of pomade.
"Laws, it's my hair grease. I put it in there to have it handy."
"Do you use your mistress's best saucers for that?"
"Law, it was 'cause I was driving in such a hurry. I was going to change it this very day."
"Here are two damask table napkins."
"Them table napkins I put there to get 'em washed out some day."
"Don't you have some place here on purpose for things to be washed?"
"Well, Master St. Clair got dat our chest, he said, for dat, but I likes to mix up biscuit and have my things in it some days, and then it ain't handy lifting up the lid."
"Why don't you mix your biscuits on the pastry table there?"
"Law, missus, it gets sot so full of dishes and one thing and another, there ain't no room no way."
"But you should wash your dishes and clear them away."
"Wash my dishes!" said Dinah in a high key, as her wrath began to rise over her habitual respective manner. "What does ladies know about work? I want to know. When a master ever get his dinner, if I was to spend all my time a-washing and putting up dishes? Miss Marie never told me so no-how."
"Well, here are these onions."
"Loss, yes," said Dinah. "There is where I put 'em. Now, I couldn't remember. Them's particular onions I was saving for dis year very stew. I'd forgot they was in that old flannel."
Miss Ophelia lifted out the sifting papers of sweet herbs.
"I wish missus wouldn't touch them ar. I likes to keep my things where I know where to go to 'em," said Dinah rather decidedly.
"But you don't want these holes in the papers."
"Them's handy for sifting on't out," said Dinah.
"But you see it spills all over the drawer."
"Laws, yes. If missus will go a-tumbling things all up so, it will. Missus has spilt lots that there way," said Dinah, coming uneasily to the drawers. "If missus will only go upstairs until my clearing up time comes, I'll have everything right. But I can't do nothing when ladies is around a-hendering. You, Sam, don't you give the baby dot our sugar bowl. I'll crack you over, if you don't mind."
"I'm going through the kitchen and going to put everything in order, once, Dinah, and then I'll expect you to keep it so."
"Lor now, Miss Ophelia, that aren't no way for ladies to do. I never did see ladies doing no such. My old missus nor Miss Marie never did, and I don't see no kind of need on it."
And Dinah stalked indignantly about, while Miss Ophelia piled and sorted dishes, emptied dozens of scattering bowls of sugar into one receptacle, sorted napkins, tablecloths, and towels for washing, washing, wiping, and arranging with her own hands, and with a speed and alacrity which perfectly amazed Dinah.
"Lord, if dat are de way dem northern ladies do, they ain't ladies nohow," she said to some of her satellites, when at a safe hearing distance. "I has things as straight as anybody when my clearing up time comes. But I don't want ladies round a-hendering and getting my things all where I can't find 'em."
To do Dinah justice, she had, at irregular periods, paroxysms of reformation and arrangement, which she called clearing up times, when she would begin with great zeal and turn every drawer and closet wrong side outward onto the floor or tables, and make the ordinary confusion sevenfold more confounded. Then she would light her pipe,
and leisurely go over her arrangements, looking things over and discoursing upon them, making all the young fries scour most vigorously on the tin things, and keeping up for several hours a most energetic state of confusion, which she would explain to the satisfaction of all inquirers by the remark that she was a-clarin' up. She couldn't have things gwine on as they had been, and she was gwine to make these ere young ones keep better order, for Dinah herself somehow indulged the illusion that she herself was the soul of order, and it was only the young uns and the everybody else in the house that were the cause of anything that fell short of perfection in this respect. When all the tins were scoured, and the tables scrubbed snowy white, and everything that could offend tucked out of sight in holes and corners, Dinah would dress herself up in a smart dress, clean apron, and high brilliant madras turban, and tell all Maraud and young'uns to keep out of the kitchen, and she was going to have things kept nice. Indeed, these periodic seasons were often an inconvenience to the whole household, for Dinah would contract such an immoderate attachment to her scoured tin as to insist upon it, and it shouldn't be used again for any possible purpose, at least till the ardor of the clarin-up period abated. Miss Ophelia in a few days thoroughly reformed every department of the house to a systematic pattern, but her labors in all department that depended on the cooperation of servants were like those of Cypheus or the Danaides. In despair, she one day appealed to St. Clair. "There is no such thing as getting anything like a system in this family." "To be sure there isn't," said St. Clair. "Such shiftless management, such waste, such confusion, I never saw." "I dare say you didn't. You would not take it so coolly if you were housekeeper." "My dear cousin, you may as well understand once for all that we masters are divided into two classes, oppressors and oppressed. We who are good-natured and hate severity make up our minds to a good deal of inconvenience. If we will keep a shambling, loose, untaught set in the community for our convenience, why, we must take the consequence. Some rare cases I have seen of persons who, by a peculiar tact, can produce order and system without severity, but I'm not one of them, and so I made up my mind long ago to let things go just as they do. I will not have the poor devils thrashed and cut to pieces, and they know it, and of course they know the staff is in their own hands. But to have no time, no place, no order, all going on in this shiftless way. My dear Vermont, you natives up by the North Pole set an extravagant value on time. What on earth is the use of time to a fellow who has twice as much of it as he knows what to do with? As to order and system, where there is nothing to be done but to lounge on the sofa and read, an hour sooner or later in breakfast isn't of account. Now there's Dinah. Gets you a capital dinner. Soup, ragout, roast, fowl, desserts, ice creams, and all. And she creates it all out of chaos, an old night down there in that kitchen. I think it really sublime, the way she manages. But heaven bless us, if we are to go down there and view all the smoking and squatting about and hurry scurrations of the preparatory process, we should never eat more. My good cousin, absolve yourself from that. It's more than a Catholic penance, and does no more good. You'll only lose your own temper and utterly confound Dinah. Let her go her own way. But, Augustine, you don't know how I found things, don't I? Don't I know that the rolling pin is under her bed, and the nutmeg grater in her pocket with her tobacco? That there are 65 different sugar bowls, one in every hole in the house? That she washes dishes with a dinner napkin one day, and with a fragment of an old petticoat the next? But the upshot is she gets up glorious dinners, makes superb coffee, and you must judge her as warriors and statesmen are judged by her success. But the waste, the expense! Ah, well, lock everything you can and keep the key. Give out by driblets, and never inquire for odds and ends. It isn't best. That troubles me, Augustine. I can't help feeling as if these servants were not strictly honest. Are you sure they can be relied on? Augustine laughed immoderately at the grave and anxious face with which Miss Ophelia propounded the question. Oh, cousin, that's too good, honest. As if that's a thing to be expected. Honest? Why, of course they aren't. Why should they be? What upon earth is to make them so? Why don't you instruct? Instruct? Oh, fiddlestick! What instructing do you think I should do? I look like it. As to Marie, she has spirit enough, to be sure, to kill off a whole plantation. If I'd let her manage, but she wouldn't get the cheatery out of them. Are there no honest ones? Well, now and then one, whom nature makes so impracticably simple, truthful, and faithful, that the worst possible influence can't destroy it. But you see, from the mother's breast the colored child feels and sees that there are none but underhand ways open to it. It can get along no other way with its parents, its mistress, its young master, and Mrs. Playfellows. Cunning and deception become necessary. Inevitable habits, it isn't fair to expect anything else of him. He ought not to be punished for it. As to honesty, the slave is kept in that dependent, semi-childish state that there is no making him realize the rights of property or feel that his master's goods are not his own, if he can get them. For my part, I don't see how they can be honest. Such a fellow as Tom here is a moral miracle. "And what becomes of their souls?" said Miss Ophelia. "That isn't my affair, as I know of," said St. Clair. "I am only dealing in facts of the present life. The fact is that the whole race are pretty generally understood to be turned over to the devil, for our benefit, in this world, however it may turn out, in another."
"This is perfectly horrible," said Miss Ophelia. "You ought to be ashamed of yourselves."
"I don't know as I am. We are in pretty good company, for all that," said St. Clair, "as people in the broad row generally are. Look at the high and the low, all the world over, and it's the same story. The lower class used up, body, soul, and spirit, for the good of the upper. It is so in England, it is so everywhere, and yet all Christendom stands aghast, with virtuous indignation, because we do the thing in a little different shape from what they do it. It isn't so in Vermont. Ah, well, in New England, and in the free states, you have the better of us, I grant. But there's the bell. So, cousin, let us for a while lay aside our sectional prejudices and come out to dinner." As Miss Ophelia was in the kitchen in the latter part of the afternoon, some of the Sable children called out, "La sakes! There's Prue a-comin', gruntin' along like she allers does." A tall, bony-colored woman now entered the kitchen, bearing on her head a basket of rusks and hot rolls.
"Ho, Prue, you've come," said Dinah.
Prue had a peculiar scowling expression of countenance and a sullen, grumbling voice. She set down her basket, squatted herself down, and resting her elbows on her knees said, "Oh, Lord, I wished I's dead."
"Why do you wish you were dead?" said Miss Ophelia.
"I'd be out all my misery," said the woman, gruffly, without taking her eyes from the floor.
"What need you getting drunk, then, and cutting up Prue?" said a spruce quadroon chambermaid, dangling as she spoke a pair of coral eardrops.
The woman looked at her with a sour, surly glance.
"Maybe you'll come to it one of these yer days. I'd be glad to see you, I would. Then you'll be glad of a drop, like me, to forget your misery."
"Come, Prue," said Dinah, "let's look at your rusks. Here's Missus, we'll pay for them."
Miss Ophelia took out a couple of dozen.
"There are some tickets in that our old cracked jug, on the top shelf," said Dinah. "You, Jake, climb up and get it down."
"Tickets? What are they for?" said Miss Ophelia.
"We buy tickets of her massa, and she gives us bread for him.
And they counts my money and tickets when I gets home, to see if I's got the change, and if I hain't, they half kills me."
"And serves you right," said Jane, the pert chambermaid, "if you will take their money to get drunk on.
That's what she does, missus."
"And that's what I will do. I can't live no other way. Drink and forget my misery."
"You are very wicked and very foolish," said Miss Ophelia, "to steal your master's money to make yourself a brute with."
"It's mighty likely, missus, but I will do it. Yes, I will. Oh, Lord, I wish I was dead, I do. I wish I was dead and out of my misery."
And slowly and stiffly the old creature rose and got her basket on her head again. But before she went out, she looked at the quadroon girt, who still stood playing with her eardrops.
"You think you're mighty fine with them are, a-frolickin' and a-tossin' your head and a-lookin' down on everybody? Well, never mind. You may live to be a poor old cut-up critter like me.
Hope to the Lord you will. I do. Then see if you won't drink, drink, drink yourself into torment. Serve you right, too. Ugh!" And with a malignant howl, the woman left the room.
"Disgusting old beast," said Adolf, who was getting his master's shaving water. "If I was her master, I'd cut her up worse than she is."
"You couldn't do that ar no way," said Dinah. "Her back's a far sight now. She can't never get her dress together over it."
"I think such low creatures ought not to be allowed to go round to genteel families," said Miss Jane. "What do you think, Mr. St. Clair?" she said, coquettishly tossing her head at Adolf.
It must be observed that, among other appropriations from his master's stock, Adolf was in the habit of adopting his name and address, and that the style under which he moved among the colored circles of New Orleans was that of Mr. St. Clair.
"I'm certainly of your opinion, Miss Benoit," said Adolf.
Benoit was the name of Marie St. Clair's family, and Jane was one of her servants.
"Pray, Miss Benoit, may I be allowed to ask if those drops are for the ball tomorrow night?
They are certainly bewitching."
"I wonder now, Mr. St. Clair, what the impudence of you men will come to," said Jane, tossing her pretty head till the eardrops twinkled again. "I shan't dance with you for a whole evening, if you go to asking me any more questions."
"Oh, you couldn't be so cruel now. I was just dying to know whether you would appear in your pink tarlatan," said Adolf.
"What is it?" said Rose, a bright, piquant little quadroon who came skipping downstairs at this moment.
"Why, Mr. St. Clair is so impudent."
"On my honour," said Adolf, "I'll leave it to Miss Rosa now." "'I know he's always a saucy creature,' said Rosa, poising herself on one of her little feet, and looking maliciously at Adolf. "'He's always getting me so angry with him.'
"'Oh, ladies, ladies, you will certainly break my heart between you,' said Adolf.
"'I shall be found dead in my bed some morning, and you'll have it to answer to.'
"'Do you hear the horrid creature talk?' said both ladies, laughing immoderately.
"'Come, clear out you. I can't have you cluttering up the kitchen,' said Dinah, in my way fooling around here.
"'Aunt Dinah's glum, because she can't go to the ball,' said Rosa.
"'Don't want none of your light-colored balls,' said Dinah, "'cutting round, making believe you's white folks. "'After all, you's niggas, much as I am.'
"'Aunt Dinah greases her wool stiff every day to make it lie straight,' said Jane.
"'And it will be wool after all,' said Rosa maliciously, shaking down her long silky curls.
"'Well, in the Lord's sight, ain't wool as good as hair any time,' said Dinah. "'I'd like to have Missus say which is worth the most, a couple such as you, or one like me. "'Get out, would you trumpery. I won't have you round.'
Here the conversation was interrupted in a twofold manner. St. Clair's voice was heard at the head of the stairs asking Adolf if he meant to stay all night with his shaving water, and Miss Ophelia, coming out of the dining room, said, "'Jane and Rosa, what are you wasting your time for here? Go in and attend to your muslins.'
Our friend Tom, who had been in the kitchen during the conversation with the old Rusk woman, had followed her out into the street. He saw her go on, giving every once in a while a suppressed groan. At last she set her basket down on a doorstep and began arranging the old faded shawl which covered her shoulders. "'I'll carry a basket apiece,' said Tom, compassionately.
"'Why should she?' said the woman. "'I don't want no help.'
"'You seem to be sick or in trouble or something,' said Tom.
"'I ain't sick,' said the woman shortly.
"'I wish,' said Tom, looking at her earnestly, "'I wish I could persuade you to leave off drinking. "'Don't you know it will be the ruin of ye body and soul?'
"'I knows I'm going to torment,' said the woman, sullenly.
"'You don't need to tell me that, or as ugly, as wicked, as going straight to torment. "'Oh, Lord, I wish I was there.'
Tom shuddered at these frightful words, spoken with a sullen, impassioned earnestness.
"'O Lord, have mercy on ye, poor critter. Haven't ye never heard of Jesus Christ?'
"'Jesus Christ? Who's he?'
"'Why, he's the Lord,' said Tom.
"'I think I've heard tell o' the Lord and the judgment and torment. I've heard of that. But didn't anybody ever tell you of the Lord Jesus that loved us poor sinners and died for us?'
"'Don't know nothing about that,' said the woman. "'Nobody had never loved me since my old man died.'
"'Where was you raised?' said Tom. "'Up in Kentuck. A man kept me to bread chillin' for market, and sold em up as fast as they got big enough. Last of all, he sold me to a speculator, and my massa got me o' him.
What set you into this bad way of drinkin'?
"'To get shed o' my misery. I had one child after I come here, and I thought then I'd have one to raise, 'cause massa wasn't a speculator. It was the purest little thing. And Missus, she seemed to think a heap on it at first. Never cried. It was lackly and fat. Missus took sick, and I tended her, and I took the fever, and my milk all left me, and the child it pined to skin and bone, and Missus wouldn't buy milk for it. She wouldn't hear to me. When I told her I hadn't milk, she said she knowed I could feed it on what other folks eat, and the child kind of pined and cried and cried and cried day and night and got all gone to skin and bones. And Missus got sot again it, and she said 'twere nothing but crossness. She wished it was dead, she said, and she wouldn't let me have it o' nights, but she said it kept me wake and made me good for nothing. She made me sleep in her room, and I had to put it away, off in a little kind of garret, and there it cried itself to death one night, it did. And I took to drinking to keep its crying out of my ears, I did. And I will drink, I will. If I go to torment for it, Master says I shall go to torment, and I tell him I've got there now.
Oh, ye poor critter, said Tom. "'Hadn't nobody never told you how the Lord Jesus loved you and died for you? "'Hadn't they told you that he'll help you, and ye can go to heaven and have rest at last?'
"'Looks like Gwyn to heaven,' said the woman. "'Ain't there where white folks, Gwyn? "'Suppose they'd have me there? "'I'd rather go to torment and get away from Massa and Missus.'
"'I had so,' she said, as with her usual groan.
"'She got her basket on her head and walked sullenly away. "'Tom turned and walked sorrowfully back to the house. In the court he met little Eva, a crown of tuber roses on her head, and her eyes radiant with delight.
"'Oh, Tom, here you are. I'm glad I found you. Papa says you may get out the ponies and take me in my little new carriage,' she said, catching his hand. "'But what's the matter, Tom? You look sober.'
"'I feel bad, Miss Eva,' said Tom sorrowfully, "'but I'll get the horses for you.'
"'But do tell me, Tom, what is the matter? I saw you talking to cross old Prue.'
Tom, in simple, earnest phrase, told Eva the woman's history.
She did not exclaim or wonder or weep, as other children do. Her cheeks grew pale, and a deep, earnest shadow passed over her eyes. She laid both hands on her bosom and sighed heavily.
Volume 2, Chapter 19. Miss Ophelia's experiences and opinions continued.
"Tom, you needn't get me the horses. I don't want to go," she said.
"Why not, Miss Eva?"
"These things sink into my heart, Tom," said Eva. "They sink into my heart," she repeated earnestly. "I don't want to go," and she turned from Tom and went into the house. A few days after, another woman came in old Prue's place to bring the rusks. Miss Ophelia was in the kitchen.
"Lor," said Dinah, "what's got Prue?"
"Prue isn't coming any more," said the woman mysteriously.
"Why not?" said Dinah. "She ain't dead, is she?"
"We doesn't exactly know."
"She's down cellar," said the woman, glancing at Miss Ophelia.
After Miss Ophelia had taken the rusks, Dinah followed the woman to the door.
"What has got Prue, anyhow?" she said. The woman seemed desirous, yet reluctant, to speak, and answered in low, mysterious tone. "Well, you mustn't tell nobody, Prue. She got drunk again, and they had her down cellar, and there they left her all day. And I heard 'em saying that the flies had got to her, and she's dead."
Dinah held up her hands, and turning, saw close by her side the spirit-like form of Evangeline, her large mystic eyes dilated with horror, and every drop of blood driven from her lips and cheeks.
"Law bless us, Miss Eva's going to faint away. Why go us all to let her hear such talk? Her pa'll be real mad."
"I shan't faint, Dinah," said the child firmly. "And why shouldn't I hear it? It ain't so much for me to hear it as for poor Prue to suffer it."
"Lord sakes, it isn't for sweet, delicate young ladies like you. These yere stories isn't. It's enough to kill 'em."
Eva sighed again and walked upstairs with a slow and melancholy step. Miss Ophelia anxiously inquired the woman's story. Dinah gave a very garrulous version of it, to which Tom added the particulars which he had drawn from her that morning.
"An abominable business, perfectly horrible," she exclaimed, as she entered the room where St. Clair lay reading his paper.
"Pray, what iniquity has turned up now?" said he.
"What now?
Why, those folks have whipped Prue to death,"
said Miss Ophelia, going on with great strength of detail, into the story and enlarging on its most shocking particulars.
"I thought it would come to that sometime," said St. Clair, going on with his paper.
"Thought so. Ain't she going to do anything about it?" said Miss Ophelia. "Haven't she got any selectmen or anybody to interfere and look after such matters?"
"It's commonly supposed that the property interest is a sufficient guard in these cases. If people choose to ruin their own possessions, I don't know what's to be done. It seems the poor creature was a thief and a drunkard, and so there won't be much hope to get up sympathy for her."
"It is perfectly outrageous. It is horrid. Augustine, it will certainly bring down vengeance upon you."
"My dear cousin, I didn't do it, and I can't help it. I would if I could, if low-minded, brutal people will act like themselves. What am I to do? They have absolute control. They are irresponsible despots. There would be no use in interfering. There is no law that amounts to anything practically for such a case. The best we can do is to shut our eyes and ears and let it alone. It's the only resource left us."
"How can you shut your eyes and ears? How can you let such things alone?"
"My dear child, what do you expect? Here is a whole class, debased, uneducated, indolent, provoking, put, without any sort of terms or conditions, entirely into the hands of such people as the majority in our world are, people who have neither consideration nor self-control, who haven't even an enlightened regard to their own interest. For that's the case with the largest half of mankind. Of course, in a community so organized, what can a man of honorable and human feelings do but shut his eyes all he can and harden his heart? I can't buy every poor wretch I see. I can't turn knight-errant and undertake to redress every individual case of wrong in such a city as this. The most I can do is to try and keep out of the way of it."
St. Clair's fine countenance was for a moment overcast. He said, "Come, cousin, don't stand there looking like one of the fates. You've only seen a peep through the curtain, a specimen of what is going on the world over in some shape or other. If we are to be prying and spying into all the dismals of life, we should have no heart to anything."
"'Tis like looking too close into the details of Dinah's kitchen," said St. Clair. and St. Clair lay back on the sofa and busied himself with his paper. Miss Ophelia sat down and pulled out her knitting work, and sat there grim with indignation. She knit and knit, but while she mused the fire burned. At last she broke out. "Tell you, Augustine, I can't get over things so, if you can. It's a perfect abomination for you to defend such a system. That's my mind."
"What now?" said St. Clair, looking up.
"At it again, eh?"
"I say it's perfectly abominable for you to defend such a system," said Miss Ophelia, with increasing warmth.
"I defend it, my dear lady." "Whoever said I did defend it?" said St. Clair.
"Of course you defend it. You all do, all you Southerners. What do you have slaves for, if you don't?"
"Are you such a sweet innocent as to suppose nobody in this world ever does what they don't think is right?
Don't you or didn't you ever do anything that you did not think quite right?"
"If I do, I repent of it, I hope," said Miss Ophelia, rattling her needles with energy.
"So do I," said St. Clair, peeling his orange. "I'm repenting of it all the time."
"What do you keep on doing it for?"
"Didn't you ever keep on doing wrong after you'd repented, my good cousin?"
"Well, only when I've been very much tempted," said Miss Ophelia.
"Well, I'm very much tempted," said St. Clair. "That's just my difficulty.
But I always resolve I won't, and I try to break off."
"Well, I have been resolving I won't, off and on, these 10 years," said St. Clair.
"But I haven't, somehow, got clear. Have you got clear of all your sins, cousin?"
"Cousin Augustine," said Miss Ophelia, seriously, and laying down her knitting work,
"I suppose I deserve that you should reprove my shortcomings. I know all you say is true enough. Nobody else feels them more than I do. But it does seem to me, after all, there is some difference between me and you. It seems to me I would cut off my right hand sooner than keep on, from day to day, doing what I thought was wrong. But then my conduct is so inconsistent with my profession. I don't wonder you reprove me."
"Oh, now, cousin," said Augustine, sitting down on the floor and laying his head back in her lap, "don't take on so awfully serious. You know what a good-for-nothing saucy boy I always was. I love to poke you up, that's all, just to see you get earnest. I do think you are desperately distressing me good. It tires me to death to think of it."
"But this is a serious subject, my boy August," said Miss Ophelia, laying her hand on his forehead.
"Dismally so," said he. "And I never want to talk seriously in hot weather. What with mosquitoes and all, a fellow can't get himself up to any very sublime moral flights, and I believe," said St. Clair, suddenly rousing himself up, "there's a theory now. I understand now why northern nations are always more virtuous than southern ones. I see into that whole subject."
"Oh, Augustine, you are a sad rattlebrain."
"Am I?"
"Well, so I am, I suppose, but for once I will be serious now. But you must hand me that basket of oranges. You see, you'll have to stay me with flagons and comfort me with apples, if I'm going to make this effort."
"Now," said Augustine, drawing the basket up, "I'll begin.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for a fellow to hold 2 or 3 dozen of his fellow worms in captivity, a decent regard to the opinions of society requires."
"I don't see that you are growing more serious," said Miss Ophelia.
"Wait, I'm coming on, you'll hear. The short of the matter is, cousin," said he, his handsome face suddenly settling into an earnest and serious expression, "on this abstract question of slavery, there can, as I think, be but one opinion. Planters, who have money to make by it, clergymen, who have planters to please, politicians, who want to rule by it, may warp and bend language and ethics to a degree that shall astonish the world at their ingenuity. They can press nature and the Bible, and nobody knows what else, into the service. But after all, neither they nor the world believe in it one particle the more. It comes from the devil. That's the short of it. And to my mind, it's a pretty respectable specimen of what he can do in his own line." Miss Ophelia stopped her knitting and looked surprised, and St. Clair, apparently enjoying her astonishment, went on. "You seem to wonder, but if you will get me fairly at it, I'll make a clean breast of it. This cursed business, accursed of God and man, what is it? Strip it of all its ornament, run it down to the root and nucleus of the whole, and what is it? Why, because my brother Quashy is ignorant and weak, and I am intelligent and strong? Because I know how and can do it, therefore, I may steal all he has, keep it, and give him only such and so much as suits my fancy. Whatever is too hard, too dirty, too disagreeable for me, I may set Quashy to doing. Because I don't like work, Quashy shall work. Because the sun burns me, Quashy shall stay in the sun. Quashy shall earn the money, and I will spend it. Quashy shall lie down in every puddle, that I may walk over dry shod. Quashy shall do my will, and not his, all the days of his mortal life, and have such chance of getting to heaven, at least, as I find convenient. This I take to be about what slavery is.
I defy anybody on earth to read our slave code as it stands in our law books, and make anything else of it. Talk of the abuses of slavery? Humbug! The thing itself is the essence of all abuse, and the only reason why the land don't sink under it, like Sodom and Gomorrah, is because it is used in a way infinitely better than it is. For pity's sake, for shame's sake, because we are men born of women, and not savage beasts, many of us do not and dare not, we would scorn to use the full power which our savage laws put into our hands. And he who goes the furthest and does the worst only uses within limits the power that the law gives him. St. Clair had started up, and as his manner was when excited, was walking with hurried steps up and down the floor. His fine face, classic as that of a Greek statue, seemed actually to burn with the fervor of his feelings. His large blue eyes flashed, and he gestured with an unconscious eagerness. Miss Ophelia had never seen him in this mood before, and she sat perfectly silent. "I declare to you," said he, suddenly stopping before his cousin, "it's no sort of use to talk or to feel on this subject, but I declare to you there have been times when I have thought, if the whole country would sink and hide all this injustice and misery from the light, I would willingly sink with it. When I have been travelling up and down on our boats, or about on my collecting tours, and reflected that every brutal, disgusting, mean, low-lived fellow I met was allowed by our laws to become absolute despot of as many men, women, and children as he could cheat, steal, or gamble money enough to buy. When I have seen such men in actual ownership of helpless children, of young girls and women, I have been ready to curse my country, to curse the human race." "Augustine, Augustine," said Miss Ophelia, "I'm sure you've said enough." "I never in my life heard anything like this, even at the North." "At the North?" said St. Clair with a sudden change of expression, and resuming something of his habitual careless tone. "Pooh! You northern folks are cold-blooded. You are cool in everything. You can't begin to curse up a hill, and down as we can, when we get fairly at it."
"Well, but the question is," said Miss Ophelia. "Oh, yes, to be sure, the question is, and a deuce of a question it is. How came you in this state of sin and misery?" "Well, I shall answer in the good old words you used to teach me Sundays. I came so by ordinary generation. My servants were my father's, and what is more, my mother's, and now they are mine. They and their increase, which bids fair to be a pretty considerable item. My father, you know, came first from New England, and he was just such another man as your father, a regular old Roman, upright, energetic, noble-minded, with an iron will. Your father settled down in New England, to rule over rocks and stones and to force an existence out of nature, and mine settled in Louisiana, to rule over men and women and force existence out of them. My mother," said St. Clair, getting up and walking to a picture at the end of the room and gazing upward with a face fervent with veneration, "she was divine. Don't look at me so. You know what I mean. She probably was of mortal birth, but as far as ever I could observe, there was no trace of any human weakness or error about her. And everybody that lives to remember her, whether bond or free servant, acquaintance, relation, all say the same. Why, cousin, that mother has been all that has stood between me and utter unbelief for years. She was a direct embodiment and personification of the New Testament, a living fact to be accounted for, and to be accounted for in no other way than by its truth. Oh, mother, mother," said St. Clair, clasping his hands in a sort of transport, and then suddenly checking himself, he came back, and seating himself on an ottoman, he went on. "My brother and I were twins, and they say, you know, that twins ought to resemble each other. But we were in all points a contrast. He had black fiery eyes, coal-black hair, a strong fine Roman profile, and a rich brown complexion. I had blue eyes, golden hair, a Greek outline, and fair complexion. He was active and observing, I dreamy and inactive. He was generous to his friends and equals, but proud, dominant, overbearing to inferiors, and utterly unmerciful to whatever set itself up against him. Truthful we both were. He from pride and courage, I from a sort of abstract ideality. We loved each other, about as boys generally do, off and on, and in general, he was my father's pet, and I my mother's. There was a morbid sensitiveness and acuteness of feeling in me on all possible subjects, of which he and my father had no kind of understanding, and with which they could have no possible sympathy. But mother did, and so when I had quarrelled with Alfred, and father looked sternly on me, I used to go off to mother's room and sit by her. I remember just how she used to look, with her pale cheeks, her deep, soft, serious eyes, her white dress. She always wore white, and I used to think of her, whenever I read in Revelations about the saints that were arrayed in fine linen, clean and white. She had a great deal of genius of one sort and another, particularly in music, and she used to sit at her organ, playing fine old majestic music of the Catholic Church, and singing with a voice more like an angel than a mortal woman.
and I would lay my head down on her lap, and cry, and dream, and feel, oh, immeasurably, things that I had no language to say. In those days this matter of slavery had never been canvassed, as it was now. Nobody dreamed of any harm in it. My father was a born aristocrat. I think in some pre-existent state he must have been in the highest circles of spirits, and brought all his old court pride along with him, for it was ingrained, bred in the bone, though he was originally of poor and not in any way of noble family. My brother was begotten in his image. Now an aristocrat, you know, the world over, has no human sympathies, beyond a certain line in society. In England the line is in one place, in Burma in another, and in America in another, but the aristocrat of all these countries never goes over it. What would be hardship and distress and injustice in his own class is a cool matter, of course, in another one. My father's dividing line was that of color. Among his equals never was a man more just and generous, but he considered the negro, through all possible gradations of color, as an intermediate link between man and animals, and graded all his idea of justice or generosity on this hypothesis. I suppose, to be sure, if anybody had asked him, plump and fair, whether they had human immortal souls, he might have hemmed and hawed and said yes. But my father was not a man much troubled with spiritualism. Religious sentiment he had none, beyond a veneration for God, as decidedly the head of the upper classes. Well, my father worked some 500 negroes. He was an inflexible, driving, punctilious businessman. Everything was to move by system, to be sustained with unfailing accuracy and precision. Now, if you take into account that all this was to be worked out by a set of lazy, twaddling, shiftless laborers, who had grown up all their lives in the absence of every possible motive to learn how to do anything but shirk, as you Vermonters say, and you'll see that there might naturally be, on his plantation, a great many things that looked horrible and distressing to a sensitive child like me. Besides all, he had an overseer, great, tall, slab-sided, two-fisted renegade son of Vermont, begging your pardon, who had gone through a regular apprenticeship in hardness and brutality, and taken his degree to be admitted to practice. My mother never could endure him, nor I, but he obtained an entire ascendancy over my father, and this man was the absolute despot of the estate. I was a little fellow then, but I had the same love that I have now for all kinds of human things, a kind of passion for the study of humanity, come in what shape it would. I was found in the cabins, and among the field hands, a great deal, and of course was a great favorite, and all sorts of complaints and grievances were breathed in my ear. And I told them to mother, and we between us formed a sort of committee for a redress of grievances. We hindered and repressed a great deal of cruelty, and congratulated ourselves on doing a vast deal of good, till, as often happens, my zeal overacted. Stubbs complained to my father that he couldn't manage the hands, and must resign his position. Father was a fond, indulgent husband, but a man that never flinched from anything that he thought necessary. And so he put down his foot, like a rock, between us and the field hands. He told my mother, in language perfectly respectful and deferential, but quite explicit, that over the house servants she should be entire mistress, but that with the field hands he could allow no interference. He revered and respected her above all living beings, but he would have said it all the same to the Virgin Mary herself if she had come in the way of his system. I used sometimes to hear my mother reasoning causes with him, endeavouring to excite his sympathies. He would listen to the most pathetic appeals with the most discouraging politeness and equanimity. "It all resolves itself into this," he would say. "Must I part with Stubbs, or keep him? Stubbs is the soul of punctuality, honesty, and efficiency, a thorough business hand, and as humane as the general run. We can't have perfection, and if I keep him, I must sustain his administration as a whole, even if there are, now and then, things that are exceptionable. All government includes some necessary hardness. General rules will bear hard on particular cases." This last maxim, my father seemed to consider a settler in most alleged cases of cruelty. After he had said that, he commonly drew up his feet on the sofa, like a man that has disposed of a business, and betook himself to a nap, or the newspaper, as the case might be. The fact is, my father showed the exact sort of talent for a statesman. He could have divided Poland as easily as an orange, or trod on Ireland as quietly and systematically as any man living. At last my mother gave up, in despair. It never will be known, till the last account, what noble and sensitive natures like hers have felt, cast, utterly helpless, into what seems to them an abyss of injustice and cruelty, and which seems so to nobody about them. It has been an age of long sorrow of such natures, in such a hell-begotten sort of world as ours. What remained for her but to train her children in her own views and sentiments? Well, after all you say about training, children will grow up substantially what they are, by nature, and only that. From the cradle Alfred was an aristocrat, and as he grew up, instinctively, all his sympathies and all his reasonings were in that line, and all mother's exhortations went to the winds,
As to me, they sunk deep into me. She never contradicted in form anything my father said, or seemed directly to differ from him. But she impressed, burnt into my very soul, with all the force of her deep, earnest nature, an idea of the dignity and worth of the meanest human soul. I have looked in her face with solemn awe, when she would point up to the stars in the evening and say to me, "See there, August? The poorest, meanest soul, on our place, will be living, when all these stars are gone forever, will live as long as God lives." She had some fine old paintings, one in particular of Jesus healing a blind man. They were very fine, and used to impress me strongly. "See there, August," she would say. "The blind man was a beggar, poor and loathsome. Therefore, he would not heal him afar off. He called him to him and put his hands on him. Remember this, my boy." If I had lived to grow up under her care, she might have stimulated me to I know not what of enthusiasm. I might have been a saint, reformer, martyr, but alas, alas, I went from her when I was only 13, and I never saw her again. St. Clair rested his head on his hands and did not speak for some minutes. After a while he looked up and went on. "What poor, mean trash this whole business of human virtue is! A mere matter, for the most part, of latitude and longitude and geographical position, acting with natural temperament. The greater part is nothing but an accident. Your father, for example, settles in Vermont, in a town where all are, in fact, free and equal, becomes a regular church member and deacon, and in due time joins an abolition society, and thinks us all little better than heathens. Yet he is, for all the world, in constitution and habit, a duplicate of my father. I can see it leaking out in 50 different ways, just the same strong, overbearing, dominant spirit. You know very well how impossible it is to persuade some of the folks in your village that Squire Sinclair does not feel above them. The fact is, though he has fallen on democratic times and embraced a democratic theory, he is to the heart an aristocrat, as much as my father, who ruled over 500 or 600 slaves." Miss Sevilla felt rather disposed to cavil at this picture, and was laying down her knitting to begin, but St. Clair stopped her. "Now I know every word you are going to say. I do not say they were alike, in fact. One fell into a condition where everything acted against the natural tendency, and the other where everything acted for it. And so one turned out a pretty willful, stout, overbearing old democrat, and the other a willful, stout old despot. If both had owned plantations in Louisiana, they would have been as like as two old bullets cast in the same mold." "What an undutiful boy you are," said Miss Ophelia. "I don't mean them any disrespect," said St. Clair. "You know reverence is not my forte. But to go back to my history. When father died, he left the whole property to us twin boys, to be divided as we should agree. There does not breathe on God's earth a nobler-souled, more generous fellow than Alfred in all that concerns his equals. And we got on admirably with this property question, without a single unbrotherly word or feeling. We undertook it to work the plantation together, and Alfred, whose outward life and capabilities had double the strength of mine, became an enthusiastic planter and a wonderfully successful one. But 2 years' trial satisfied me that I could not be a partner in that matter. To have a great gang of 700, whom I could not know personally or feel any individual interest in, bought and driven, housed, fed, worked like so many horned cattle, strained up to military precision, the question of how little of life's commonest enjoyments would keep them in working order, being a constantly recurring problem, the necessity of drivers and overseers, the ever-necessary whip, first, last, and only argument, the whole thing was insufferably disgusting and loathsome to me, and when I thought of my mother's estimate of one poor human soul, it became even frightful. It's all nonsense to talk to me about slaves enjoying all this. To this day I have no patience with the unutterable trash that some of your patronizing northerners have made up, as in their zeal to apologize for our sins. We all know better. Tell me that any man living wants to work all his days from day dawn till dark under the constant eye of a master, without the power of putting forth one irresponsible volition, on the same dreary, monotonous, unchanging toil, and all for 2 pairs of pantaloons and a pair of shoes a year, with enough food and shelter to keep him in working order. Any man who thinks that human beings can, as a general thing, be made about as comfortable that way as any other, I wish he might try it. I'd buy the dog and work him with a clear conscience." "I always have supposed," said Miss Ophelia, "that you, all of you, approved of these things, and thought them right according to Scripture." "Humbug! We are not quite reduced to that yet. Alfred, who is as determined a despot as ever walked, does not pretend to this kind of defense. No, he stands high and haughty on that good old respectable ground, the right of the strongest, and he says, I think quite sensibly, that the American planter is only doing in other form what the English aristocracy and capitalists are doing by the lower classes. That is, I take it, appropriating them, body and bone, soul and spirit, to their use and convenience. He defends both, and I think at least consistently. He says that there can be no high civilization without enslavement of the masses, either nominal or real. There must, he says, be a lower class, given up to physical toil and confined to an animal nature, and a higher one thereby acquires leisure and wealth for a more expanded intelligence and improvement, and becomes the directing soul of the lower. So he reasons, because, as I said, he is born an aristocrat. So I don't believe, because I was born a democrat. How in the world can the two things be compared, said Miss Ophelia. The English laborer is not sold, traded, parted from his family, whipped. He is as much at the will of his employer as if he were sold to him. The slave owner can whip his refractory slave to death. The capitalist can starve him to death. As to family security, it is hard to say which is the worst, to have one's children sold or see them starve to death at home. But it's no kind of apology for slavery to prove that it isn't worse than some other bad thing. I didn't give it for one. Nay, I'll say besides that ours is the more bold and palpable infringement of human rights. Actually buying a man up like a horse, looking at his teeth, cracking his joints, and tying his paces and then paying down for him, having speculators, breeders and traders, brokers and human bodies and souls, sets the thing before the eyes of the civilized world in a more tangible form, though the thing done be, after all, in its nature the same. That is, appropriating one set of human beings to the use and improvement of another, without any regard to their own. I never thought of the matter in this light, said Miss Ophelia. Well, I've traveled in England some, and I've looked over a good many documents as to the state of their lower classes, and I really think there is no denying Alfred when he says that his slaves are better off than a large class of the population of England. You see, you must not infer from what I have told you that Alfred is what is called a hard master, for he isn't. He is despotic and unmerciful to insubordination. He would shoot a fellow down with as little remorse as he would shoot a buck if he opposed him. But in general, he takes a sort of pride in having his slaves comfortably fed and accommodated. When I was with him, I insisted that he should do something for their instruction, and to please me, he did get a chaplain, and used to have him catechized Sunday, though I believe in his heart that he thought it would do about as much good to set a chaplain over his dogs and horses. And the fact is that a mind stupefied and animalized by every bad influence from the hour of birth, spending the whole of every weekday in unreflecting toil, cannot be done much with by a few hours on Sunday. The teachers of Sunday schools among the manufacturing population of England and among plantation hands in our country could perhaps testify to the same result there and here. Yet some striking exceptions there are among us, from the fact that the Negro is naturally more impressible to religious sentiment than the white. Well, said Miss Ophelia, how came you to give up your plantation life? Well, we jogged on together some time till Alfred saw plainly that I was no planter. He thought it absurd, after he had reformed and altered and improved everywhere to suit my notions, that I still remained unsatisfied. The fact was, it was, after all, the thing that I hated, the using these men and women, the perpetuation of all this ignorance, brutality, and vice, just to make money for me. Besides, I was always interfering in the details. Being myself one of the laziest of mortals, I had altogether too much fellow feeling for the lazy, and when poor shiftless dogs put stones at the bottom of their cotton baskets to make them weigh heavier, or filled their sacks with dirt with cotton at the top, it seemed so exactly like what I should do if I were they. I couldn't and wouldn't have them flogged for it. Well, of course, there was an end of plantation discipline, and Alf and I came to about the same point that I and my respected father did, years before. So he told me that I was a womanish sentimentalist, and would never do for business life, and advised me to take the bank stock and the New Orleans family mansion, and go to writing poetry, and let him manage the plantation. So we parted, and I came here. But why didn't you free your slaves? Well, I wasn't up to that. To hold them as tools for money-making, I could not. Have them to help spend money, you know, didn't look quite so ugly to me. Some of them were old house servants, to whom I was much attached, and the younger ones were children to the old. All were well satisfied to be as they were. He paused and walked reflectively up and down the room. There was, said St. Clair, a time in my life when I had plans and hopes of doing something in this world, more than to float and drift. I had vague, indistinct yearnings to be a sort of emancipator, to free my native land from this spot and stain. All young men have had such fever fits, I suppose, sometime. But then, why didn't you, said Miss Ophelia. You ought not to put your hand to the plough and look back. Oh, well, things didn't go with me as I expected, and I got the despair of living that Solomon did. I suppose it was a necessary incident to wisdom in us both. But somehow or other, instead of being actor and regenerator in society, I became a piece of driftwood, and have been floating and eddying about ever since. Alfred scolds me. Every time we meet, and he has the better of me, I grant, for he really does something. His life is a logical result of his opinions, and mine is a contemptible non sequitur.
My dear cousin, can you be satisfied with such a way of spending your probation?
Satisfied? Was I not just telling you I despised it? But then, to come back to this point, we were on this liberation business. I don't think my feelings about slavery are peculiar. I find many men who, in their hearts, think of it just as I do. The land groans under it.
And bad as it is for the slave, it is worse, if anything, for the master.
It takes no spectacles to see that a great class of vicious, improvident, degraded people among us are an evil to us as well as to themselves. The capitalist and aristocrat of England cannot feel that as we do, because they do not mingle with the class they degrade as we do. They are in our homes, they are the associates of our children,
and they form their minds faster than we can, for they are a race that children always will cling to and assimilate with.
If Eva now was not more angel than ordinary, she would be ruined. We might as well allow the smallpox to run among them and think our children would not take it, as to let them be uninstructed and vicious, and think our children will not be affected by that.
Yet our laws positively and utterly forbid any efficient general education system. And they do it wisely, too. For just begin and thoroughly educate one generation, and the whole thing would be blown sky high. If we did not give them liberty, they would take it.
And what do you think will be the end of this? Said Miss Ophelia.
I don't know. One thing is certain, that there is a mustering among the masses, the world over, and there is a dies irae coming on, sooner or later. The same thing is working in Europe, in England, and in this country. My mother used to tell me of a millennium that was coming when Christ should reign and all men should be free and happy. And she taught me when I was a boy to pray, Thy kingdom come. Sometimes I think all this sighing and groaning and stirring among the dry bones foretells what she used to tell me was coming. But who may abide the day of his appearing?
Augustine, sometimes I think you are not far from the kingdom, said Miss Ophelia, laying down her knitting and looking anxiously at her cousin.
Thank you for your good opinion, but it's up and down with me, up to heaven's gate in theory, down in earth's dust in practice. But there's the tea bell. Do let's go. And don't say now I haven't had one downright serious talk for once in my life.
At table, Marie alluded to the incident of Prue. I suppose you'll think, cousin, she said, that we are all barbarians.
I think that's a barbarous thing, said Miss Ophelia, but I don't think you are all barbarians.
Well now, said Marie, I know it's impossible to get along with some of these creatures. They are so bad they ought not to live. I don't feel a particle of sympathy for such cases. If they'd only behave themselves, it would not happen.
But, Mama, said Eva, the poor creature was unhappy. That's what made her drink.
Oh, fiddlestick! As if that were any excuse. I'm unhappy very often, I presume, she said pensively. That I've had greater trials than ever she had. It's just because they are so bad. There's some of them that you cannot break in by any kind of severity. I remember father had a man that was so lazy, he would run away just to get rid of work, and lie around in the swamp stealing and doing all sorts of horrid things. That man was caught and whipped time and again, and it never did him any good, and the last time he crawled off, though he couldn't but just go, and died in the swamp. There was no sort of reason for it, for father's hands were always treated kindly.
I broke a fellow in once, said St. Clair, that all the overseers and masters had tried their hands on in vain.
You, said Marie, well, I'd be glad to know when you ever did anything of the sort.
Well, he was a powerful, gigantic fellow, a native-born African, and he appeared to have the rude instinct of freedom in him, to an uncommon degree. He was a regular African lion. They called him Scipio. Nobody could do anything with him, and he was sold round from overseer to overseer, till at last Alfred bought him, because he thought he could manage him. Well, one day he knocked down the overseer and was fairly off into the swamps. I was on a visit to Alf's plantation, for it was after we had dissolved the partnership. Alfred was greatly exasperated, but I told him that it was his own fault and laid him any wager that I could break the man, and finally it was agreed that if I caught him, I should have him to experiment on. So they mustered out a party of some 6 or 7 with guns and dogs for the hunt. People, you know, can get up as much enthusiasm in hunting a man as a deer, if it is only customary, in fact. I got a little excited myself, though I had only put in as a sort of mediator in case he was caught. Well, the dogs bayed and howled, and we rode and scampered, and finally we started him. He ran and bounded like a buck, and kept us well in the rear for some time. But at last he got caught in an impenetrable thicket of cane. Then he turned to bay, and I tell you he fought the dogs right gallantly. He dashed them to right and left and actually killed 3 of them with only his naked fists.
when a shot from a gun brought him down, and he fell wounded and bleeding, almost at my feet. The poor fellow looked up at me with manhood and despair both in his eye. I kept back the dogs and the party as they came pressing up, and claimed him as my prisoner. It was all I could do,